She was 12 years old when she told Eddie Willers that she would run the railroad when they grew up. She was 15 when it occurred to her for the first time that women did not run railroads and that people might object. To hell with that, she thought, and never worried about it again. She went to work for Taggart Transcontinental at the age of 16. Her father permitted it. He was amused and a little curious. She started as night operator at a small country station. She had to work nights for the first few years while attending a college of engineering. James Taggart began his career on the railroad at the same time. He was 21. He started in the Department of Public Relations. Dagny's rise among the men who operated Taggart Transcontinental was swift and uncontested. She took positions of responsibility because there was no one else to take them. There were a few rare men of talent around her, but they were becoming rarer every year. Her superiors, who held the authority, seemed afraid to exercise it. They spent their time avoiding decisions. So she told people what to do, and they did it. At every step of her rise, she did the work long before she was granted the title. It was like advancing through empty rooms. Nobody opposed her, yet nobody approved of her progress. Her father seemed astonished and proud of her, but he said nothing, and there was sadness in his eyes when he looked at her in the office. She was 29 years old when he died. "There has always been a Taggart to run the railroad," was the last thing he said to her. He looked at her with an odd glance. It had the quality of a salute and of compassion together. The controlling stock of Taggart Transcontinental was left to James Taggart. He was 34 when he became president of the railroad. Dagny had expected the board of directors to elect him, but she had never been able to understand why they did it so eagerly. They talked about tradition. The president had always been the eldest son of the Taggart family. They elected James Taggart in the same manner as they refused to walk under a ladder, to propitiate the same kind of fear. They talked about his gift of making railroads popular, his good press, his Washington ability. He seemed unusually skillful at obtaining favors from the legislature. Dagny knew nothing about the field of Washington ability or what such an ability implied, but it seemed to be necessary, so she dismissed it with the thought that there were many kinds of work which were offensive yet necessary, such as cleaning sewers. Somebody had to do it, and Jim seemed to like it. She had never aspired to the presidency. The operating department was her only concern. When she went out on the line, old railroad men who hated Jim said, "There will always be a Taggart to run the railroad," looking at her as her father had looked. She was armed against Jim by the conviction that he was not smart enough to harm the railroad too much, and that she would always be able to correct whatever damage he caused. At 16, sitting at her operator's desk, watching the lighted windows of Taggart trains roll past, she had thought that she had entered her kind of world. In the years since, she learned that she hadn't. The adversary she found herself forced to fight was not worth matching or beating. It was not a superior ability which she would have found honor in challenging. It was ineptitude. A gray spread of cotton that seemed soft and shapeless, that could offer no resistance to anything or anybody, yet managed to be a barrier in her way. She stood disarmed before the riddle of what made this possible. She could find no answer. It was only in the first few years that she felt herself screaming silently at times for a glimpse of human ability, a single glimpse of clean, hard, radiant competence. She had fits of tortured longing for a friend or an enemy with a mind better than her own. But the longing passed. She had a job to do. She did not have time to feel pain. Not often. The first step of the policy that James Taggart brought to the railroad was the construction of the San Sebastian line. Many men were responsible for it, but to Dagny, one name stood written across that venture, a name that wiped out all others wherever she saw it. It stood across 5 years of struggle, across miles of wasted track, across sheets of figures that recorded the losses of Taggart Transcontinental, like a red trickle from a wound which would not heal, as it stood on the ticker tape of every stock exchange left in the world, as it stood on smokestacks in the red glare of furnaces melting copper, as it stood in scandalous headlines, as it stood on parchment pages recording the nobility of the centuries, as it stood on cards attached to flowers in the boudoirs of women scattered through three continents. The name was Francisco d'Anconia. At the age of 23, when he inherited his fortune, Francisco d'Anconia had been famous as the Copper King of the world. Now at 36, he was famous as the richest man and the most spectacularly worthless playboy on earth. He was the last descendant of one of the noblest families of Argentina. He owned cattle ranches, coffee plantations, and most of the copper mines of Chile. He owned half of South America and sundry mines scattered through the United States as small change. When Francisco d'Anconia suddenly bought miles of bare mountains in Mexico, news leaked out that he had discovered vast deposits of copper. He made no effort to sell stock in his venture. The stock was begged out of his hands, and he merely chose those whom he wished to favor from among the applicants. His financial talent was called phenomenal. No one had ever beaten him in any transaction. He added to his incredible fortune with every deal he touched and every step he made, when he took the trouble to make it. Those who censured him most were first to seize the chance of riding on his talent toward a share of his new wealth. James Taggart, Orrin Boyle, and their friends were among the heaviest stockholders of the project, which Francisco d'Anconia had named the San Sebastian Mines. Dagny was never able to discover what influences prompted James Taggart to build a railroad branch from Texas into the wilderness of San Sebastian. It seemed likely that he did not know it himself. Like a field without a windbreak, he seemed open to any current, and the final sum was made by chance. A few among the directors of Taggart Transcontinental objected to the project. The company needed all its resources to rebuild the Rio Norte line. It could not do both. But James Taggart was the road's new president. It was the first year of his administration. He won. The People's State of Mexico was eager to cooperate and signed a contract guaranteeing for 200 years the property right of Taggart Transcontinental to its railroad line in a country where no property rights existed. Francisco d'Anconia had obtained the same guarantee for his mines. Dagny fought against the building of the San Sebastian line. She fought by means of whoever would listen to her. But she was only an assistant in the operating department, too young, without authority, and nobody listened. She was unable then or since to understand the motives of those who decided to build the line. Sitting as a helpless spectator, a minority member at one of the board meetings, she felt a strange evasiveness in the air of the room, in every speech and every argument, as if the real reason of their decision were never stated, but clear to everyone except herself. They spoke about the future importance of the trade with Mexico, about a rich stream of freight, about the large revenues assured to the exclusive carrier of an inexhaustible supply of copper. They proved it by citing Francisco d'Anconio's past achievements. They did not mention any mineralogical facts about the San Sebastian mines. Few facts were available. The information which d'Anconia had released was not very specific. But they did not seem to need facts. They spoke at great length about the poverty of the Mexicans and their desperate need of railroads. They've never had a chance. It is our duty to help an underprivileged nation to develop. A country, it seems to me, is its neighbor's keeper. She sat listening, and she thought of the many branch lines which Taggart Transcontinental had had to abandon. The revenues of the great railroad had been falling slowly for many years. She thought of the ominous need of repairs, ominously neglected over the entire system. Their policy on the problem of maintenance was not a policy, but a game they seemed to be playing with a piece of rubber that could be stretched a little, then a little more. The Mexicans, it seems to me, are a very diligent people, crushed by their primitive economy. How can they become industrialized if nobody lends them a hand? When considering an investment, we should, in my opinion, take a chance on human beings rather than on purely material factors. She thought of an engine that lay in a ditch beside the Rio Norte line because a splice bar had cracked. She thought of the 5 days when all traffic was stopped on the Rio Norte line because a retaining wall had collapsed, pouring tons of rock across the track. Since a man must think of the good of his brothers before he thinks of his own, it seems to me that a nation must think of its neighbors before it thinks of itself. She thought of a newcomer called Ellis Wyatt, whom people were beginning to watch because his activity was the first trickle of a torrent of goods about to burst from the dying stretches of Colorado. The Rio Norte line was being allowed to run its way to a final collapse, just when its fullest efficiency was about to be needed and used.